Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota's congressional delegation is calling for transparency after yesterday's announcement that House Democrats are seeking a formal impeachment inquiry with respect to President Donald Trump's phone conversation with the president of the Ukraine on July 25th. Meanwhile, President Trump says he has released the transcript of the call, but is it a transcript, really? And closer to home, the South Dakota Democratic Party's financial woes continue, and their treasurer has announced his retirement. It's time to dive in with the Dakota Political Junkies. Joining us from the Tom and Danielle Amon Foundation studio in Aberdeen, we have John Schaff. He's professor of political science at Northern State University. Welcome back, John. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
On the phone with us, we have Jonathan Ellis, investigative reporter and columnist for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, just another sleepy day, Lori.
Just wake up, you get hit by the train of the daily news, right? Jonathan, let's start with you because we want to start particularly with the conversation about the president as it looks in South Dakota, because we often turn to, really in this day and age, we expect statements, many cases tweets, from our congressional delegation pretty quickly about what they feel about something. Give us an idea of how they're weighing in on the situation with impeachment and the president.
Well, I think, you know, it's important to note that their comments were made. I haven't seen anything recently with regard to the memo that came out today, but their comments were made before this memo came out, and nothing to me was very surprising in what they said. I mean, you never go wrong by asking for transparency in a process, I think it's important to note that the two Republican senators support having this this whistleblower report into the Ukraine issue delivered to Congress, which the administration has not done. So I think that's kind of a interesting significant step in all of this, but have not seen the reaction based upon what is in this very interesting 5-page memo that was released today.
All right. And Jonathan's used two words there, transcript and memo. And I don't know if you've seen the Merriam-Webster Twitter feed, but they have tweeted out the definition of transcript versus the definition of memorandum, just so people are going to kind of use that correctly. Transcript is a typed copy of dictated or recorded material, in case you were wondering. A memorandum is an informal report or message. So we can all get that right. John Schaff, what are your thoughts about how this is starting to unfold?
Yeah, I think actually, if you look at the document that the White House released, I think it's not labeled as a transcript.
Yeah. Well, the president kept saying he would release the transcript.
Is it?
No, that's the subtext sass from the Merriam-Webster Twitter feed, I think.
Yeah. It looks like a transcript, but as we understand it, it is some sort of cobbled together piece of this conversation put together by national security staff. I noticed that yesterday Mike Rounds sent a tweet out that he wishes that Democrats would spend more time on working for the American people than on trying to overturn the results of the 2016 election. That's a paraphrase. That's not exactly what he said, but that's a paraphrase of what he said. And so what I find interesting is, as Jonathan said, that our two senators have come out in favor of transparency. And I guess we're getting some of that transparency with this memo, whatever we want to call it. Let's just generically call it a document. With this document, we'll see if the president ends up sharing the whistleblower's report with Congress. But it's unlikely, it seems, that the president would have produced this document or be on the verge, possibly, of having of releasing the whistleblower's report if it wasn't for the threat of impeachment. And so this is sort of how this is really, in a way, is supposed to go, is that I don't think the president has any legal obligation to turn either of these two documents over to Congress. But politically, it's becoming difficult for him not to do so. And it's because he's getting political pressure. But if we didn't put that pressure on the president, I don't think we would have seen either one of these things. And so if our delegation is saying it's good that we see these things, then we need to apply pressure to the president.
So John Thune's quotation was, the president has described it as a very appropriate conversation, but I think we'll see what the facts say. That's, again, before he saw. And then the quotation that John is referring to, Jonathan Ellis, is from Senator Rounds, I wish they would spend this much energy on improving the lives of South Dakotans, such as passing the USMCA trade agreement, getting our fiscal house in order, and reducing burdensome regulations. That's from Senator Mike Rounds. Jonathan, is Senator Rounds trying to pivot to the USMCA there? Is he trying to just point out the politics behind this? How do you sort of interpret that comment?
Yeah, I mean, sure, I think, we'll see how this kind of plays out in the next few days. But clearly, we're gearing up for what will be a very, political process, partisan process. And Republicans, I think, will probably, there will be, at least initially, will probably be defensive of the president. We have to go back, I think, to the Watergate hearings, and before anything happens. I mean, they're going to have to be some Republicans who decide they've had enough, and I don't see that has happened yet. So the USMCA trade agreement, that's something that the two our congressional delegation has been pounding away on, and I think even the governor had kind of a snarky tweet, something to, after Speaker Pelosi announced her intent to pursue this the impeachment process, that she had kind of a snarky tweet saying, "I wish that they would spend more time, as much time legislating, and she referenced the USMCA as they do going after the president." So, yeah, I mean, clearly they're trying to make this an issue and focus on issues that are more probably, certainly this trade agreement would be more affect more of South Dakotans, especially our farmers.
Yeah, and U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson, the last time he was on this program, and certainly he said it with other into other outlets as well, that he's experiencing a high level of frustration about that USMCA agreement being pretty close to ready to go, and he feels it's not getting the attention that it deserves in the House because the Democrats are sort of holding it hostage. John Schaaf, it's an opportunity to say, as this goes forward in Washington, what doesn't get done, what's held up, what grinds to a halt as these conversations ensue, not insignificant to the people of South Dakota.
Well, I think we can see that now there is bipartisan intransigence for doing anything in Congress. I saw something the other day that outside of like the national defense, the defense appropriations, and there was one other bill that the Senate has passed, nothing of any substance. They've only passed a handful of bills, and most of those were commemorative. So the Senate's not really doing much other than confirming judges and doing a handful of budget things. The House, now under Democratic control, seems to be following suit for probably much of the same reasons, for political reasons. And part of the problem is what should be happening at this point is that when we've got a divided Congress like this, there should be leadership from the White House. But the whole point is that the White House seems to be constantly distracted by the president stepping on various rakes and dealing with political problems. Part of that is the partisanship of the other side. There's no doubt that they throw rakes in front of him sometimes for him to step on. But that seems to be that everyone is more focused towards a 2020 election and positioning themselves than doing anything. Meanwhile, well, we'll talk about disaster relief here perhaps in a minute. That just takes a presidential declaration. But we've got in our state farmers who are struggling. We've got an economy that I would say is basically mediocre economy, all sorts of things that maybe we want to be focusing on, whether it's education policy, we've got healthcare policy that we need to be focusing on. And instead, we're having a spitball contest in Washington, D.C., and I don't think anyone wins the spitball contest.
Let's talk about that disaster declaration, because this is President Trump approved South Dakota's request. Disaster assistance declaration number two, Jonathan. It's been a tough year in the state of South Dakota. Might not be the last news of this like between now and the end of the year either.
Yeah, no, I think there are some other pending declarations out there. Second one of the year, as you know, disaster declarations are kind of an interesting deal. They become certainly more common, and not to downgrade what we've experienced, but there was a time when disaster declarations were much harder to get, or they weren't as frequent. And I think during the Bill Clinton years, they ramped up, and they've kind of never really gone back down. So they become more common, I think, than certainly they were 25, 30 years ago.
Hmm. And John Schaff, how important is that to these counties and townships that the fact that they are a little more common?
Well, yeah, what we've seen in our state, obviously, it's mostly moisture, and I understand a few weeks ago you guys had a bit of wind down in Sioux
Falls.
Little
bit, yeah.
What we've got is that we're a state that perennially has infrastructure issues. A handful of years ago, we passed some tax and fee increases to help improve our road infrastructure, but nothing damages that like moisture. And so if we want to get from one place to another, both for personal reasons and obviously for commercial reasons, we need to have our roads and bridges in shape, and all this moisture we've gotten. And then also look at all the property damage down in Sioux Falls to businesses. This really affects people's lives if they can't engage in work. And so the federal government, I think to its benefit, has stepped in and can really make an impact in people's lives as they lose livestock, as they lose crops, people become unemployed or unable to get around because of bad infrastructure conditions. The federal government can really make up a difference in that, because obviously the state itself has limited resources, and the whole point of a disaster is a disaster. It's beyond the regular, ordinary functioning of the state government, and the federal government, with its ability to marshal resources that are beyond the capacity of the state, really is doing its duty when it comes in and helps us with these sorts of things.
Yeah. Let's talk limited resources and then talk about the South Dakota Democratic Party, because there's new developments. And Jonathan, was it you who talked about this last time with us, is sort of what was happening in the party finances and the fact that the treasurer was still there? Not so anymore.
Longtime treasurer. And I think since 2000, Bill Niblick, if I'm getting that correct. I mean, he's been around for a long time, and was around in some good times for the Democratic Party. If you remember in 2000, I mean, they had the two Senate seats. There was a brief period of time when Stephanie Hursa-Sandlin won that House seat, where they had the complete congressional delegation during that special election. So. He's been around for the good times and the bad, and they are in the bad, very bad period of time. And so they've ended, there's FEC audit going on right now of money that was, funneled through the state committee in order to help Hillary Clinton's campaign. They were not reporting debt that they had. Reported a negative cash and balance. I mean, they've had to close their offices. I mean, these are very tough times for them. So he's been around for, 20 years or thereabouts for the good times for the Democratic Party, and now what would be seemingly disastrous if it turns out that the Democratic National Committee is ceasing sending donations or supporting the state party. They would be in very big trouble.
Right. Now, he has officially retired, and Paula Hawks will serve as the interim treasurer until they elect a new treasurer this weekend. John Schaff, how bad is bad, and how do you turn bad around? They're really spinning kind of an optimistic, we're cooperating, people are coming forward to help, we don't need offices to go door to door and, talk about our ideas and our candidates. They're putting the best foot forward, but it's a pretty dire situation.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, the way the party is talking about it is, they don't need these physical offices to do grassroots activity. And there's at least a claim that they've got new donors coming in. I think the fear would be, I think it's the state of Alabama, that the Democratic National Committee has sort of cut off the state party because of these sorts of things and an inability to be competitive and the ability to run a competent organization. And so it's not just the dire financial situation of the state, and as we've talked about this before, the party is in sort of this vicious circle where it can't win, therefore it has a hard time raising money. Because it has a hard time raising money, it can't win. And when you have a hard time raising money, it's a hard time putting together organization. And so this all sort of works in a symbiosis that is bad for the party. But it's also a fact that when you're filing incorrect forms with the FEC, and they've had other problems like this where it seems like it's a sort of gang that can't shoot straight. And so they've got a lot of new leadership. They'll have more new leadership when they get a new treasury on board. And I think the first thing to do is to show that you can run a competent organization that can pay its bills on time, that can file paperwork on time, that can run a state convention in a competent manner. And then, it is all about legwork. And you wish that there was, I suppose, some magic way. Every politician wishes there's some magic wand they could swish around and I just created 20% more voters. But the only way to do that, the magic wand, is a lot of work. And that's what they're going to have to do of changing hearts and minds and probably think really hard about how do they portray themselves to the people of South Dakota. The biggest problem, I think, electorally the party has, in addition to all the things we're talking about, is there's become such a split between where the national party is and where we are locally that previously when John talks about those salad days of when the Democratic Party had the entire congressional delegation, all that delegation in one way, shape, or form could make some sort of claim to moderation. And it's harder and harder for Democrats in South Dakota to say, we can be moderate, but look at all these people in Washington, D.C. who, there is no moderation in the Democratic Party on the national level. So it leads to this sense that if you vote for a Democrat here, you're voting for Nancy Pelosi or you're voting for Barack Obama. And South Dakota doesn't want to give power to those people. And so it's really got to overcome that on the national level. And so maybe the focus needs to be at state legislative races, which is what they're talking about, is these local races are the way to build things up. Even school boards and city council positions are the way to build that bench that you can then move up. And this, it might be a decade-long process of getting the party back into competition, the Democratic Party back in competition in the state. And so it takes a lot of patience and a lot of hard work.
Jonathan, it seems that brings to mind the campaign ad against, Billy Sutton, where his face morphed into Hillary Clinton's. The Republicans or the opponents of the Democrats definitely know that making that attachment to what John was saying to the National Party and the further left, people in that party is definitely going to sting here in South Dakota.
Yeah, I mean, and I think for more uninformed voters, they may have seen sort of Billy Sutton's initial ads that are very good and thought, oh, he might be the Republican candidate,
Right.
So the Republicans had to kind of remind voters like, oh, these are these national, as John mentions, that they're much more extreme than most, moderate voters here. And associate their candidates. I think, if you look at history, I think the Democrats have done well here when there have been Republicans in charge and screwing things up, especially in the farm economy. I think when George McGovern won his first race in 1956, I think that was the start of Eisenhower's second term, if I'm getting my history correct here. But there was an unpopular ag secretary, Ezra Benson, was very unpopular. Farm country was kind of hurting. The problem that exists now that they didn't have in the 50s is that farm demographic has dwindled mightily since then. So. For the Democrats, not only are they going to have to work hard, as John says, but they're going to need some help from Republicans on a Republican administration to really become unpopular.
And Jonathan brings the history, and John Schaff has got bipartisan and transient and symbiosis from a vocabulary. We're cooking today there.
I'm impressed you're keeping track, or maybe slightly disturbed. I don't know which I should be.
I'm making notes for the PhD award at the end of the hour goes to Professor John Schaff.
Win again.
Let's close up with, and the history award goes to Jonathan Ellis. So I don't know how you feel about that, Professor Schaff. But all right.
I'm happy to concede.
Let's talk about drug laws before we go. We'll pick one out of the pile here. And because lawmakers are calling for a fix to South Dakota drug laws, that's the headline in the Argus Leader Lisa's piece there. And Jonathan, give us an idea of why this is a conversation right now, because we're looking at some of these, these laws that are on the books in South Dakota that are very different from other states.
Well, the big one is ingestion, and we've written about that. We treat that as there's a felony ingestion law, which is unusual. I don't think any other states have that. And the question is whether or not that law is leading to over-incarceration, and whether or whether there should be other avenues in which people who are testing positive for ingestion or whatever that we as a system try to get them into treatment programs rather than the legal system itself, whether it's probation or incarceration. So incarcerating people is a very expensive process. I mean, and so I think they're looking at those laws. And one of the things that I don't know if this came up in the committee hearing when they're talking about this, but when you look at how many states have legalized some level of marijuana. And people who, and obviously the THC can stay in your system for weeks, and you happen to come here and you were in Colorado for a vacation and happen to imbibe there because it's legal. What happens here if you, so I think there are a lot of, on the ingestion front, I think there are going to be a lot of questions. I would suspect that they'll, with prosecutors and law enforcement behind pushing for some changes, we'll likely see that in the legislature. Mm.
John Chaff, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is the state is looking at perhaps maybe coming up with a more sophisticated way, if I can put it that way, of dealing with drug offenses. And so we tend to have a more simplified, I don't want to say one size fits all, but it may be a small number of sizes fits all way of approaching drug offenses. And other states, it seems, have more gradations, more variety in how they treat, how much of a particular substance do you have on you or in you, and various levels of ramping up before you get to that incarceration. I think everybody understands, there's a national movement that on the whole, we'd rather not incarcerate people for drug offenses, especially if it's merely ingestion of a drug. Because as Jonathan says, it's extremely expensive. What's also extremely expensive is for a person to have a revolving door where they go through treatment, come back, get back into addiction, then they're in front of the criminal justice system again, and that becomes expensive as well. And so I think that the state is looking at ways, how can we keep people out of prison? But also I think it seems like we need to be putting more effort into maybe longer stays in treatment at state expense, and to make sure when we put someone into a treatment instead of incarceration that they actually come out clean, instead of it simply being a revolving door of possession and ingestion offenses that then eventually will ramp up and they'll end up in prison eventually as they get multiple convictions. Mm. The goal is to get people off of drugs, not put people in jail.
We will leave it there. Gentlemen, thank you so much. John Schaff with Aberdeen Northern State University. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Jonathan Ellis, you can find his work at argusleader.com. Jonathan, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks, Lori.